Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you all here today. Two summers ago, when I was teaching or offering commentaries on Kagari Roshi's book, You Have to Say Something, the middle section on egolessness, there was one section there titled Medicine and Disease. And the first part of that section, he brought up a number of interesting points, all of which I felt I had quite a bit to say about, but I couldn't take the time in that class because we had to move through the book. And I made a little note in the margin that this would be a good topic for just a separate talk, because I probably would have spent the whole hour on it in the class, and we couldn't take that kind of time. So now I'd like to just pick up on that. So from this section, Medicine and Disease, in his book, You Have to Say Something, and Katagiri Roshi, I'll just quickly move through these remarkable features that he states here very quickly, and then we'll go back over them. He says that Buddhism teaches that the ultimate nature of being has several remarkable features. The first is that it is vast, all-pervading, and seamless. The second is that it lacks form, color, smell, and flavor. The third feature of the ultimate nature of being is that it acts at super speed. Yet it is always tranquil and very quiet, which is the fourth feature. The fifth feature is that because nature is very active, things are constantly arising and perishing. All things are interconnected and arise together, yet each arises under different conditions. The sixth feature is that when we are conscious of something, say a tree, precisely and clearly as it appears, all beings appear along with it as the very quality of its life. And then, jumping down a little bit, even though all beings exist in this moment, the single frame your consciousness picks up appears to be absolutely alone. If you pick out yourself, you will appear to be alone too. Well, these are rather interesting points, most of which I didn't comment on in the class, so we can do that now. He says, Buddhism teaches that the ultimate nature of being has several remarkable features. The first is that it is vast, all-pervading, and seamless. The second is that it lacks form, color, smell, and flavor. This ultimate nature of being, what is he talking about? Well, of course, he's talking about reality. He's talking about what you are. We could say this is self-nature, true nature, Buddha nature, many words for this. He's talking about reality, what is really going on here. When it's expressed as being, as he states it here, we might have the impression that we're talking about something that exists or something that's persisting as apart from something, say, that doesn't exist. We might be thinking that we're talking about being as opposed to non-being, something of this sort. Well, the ultimate nature of reality, or the ultimate nature of being, doesn't lie actually in being at all. It has these peculiar qualities, as he states. So basically, he's kind of approaching this from the standpoint of how we usually think of things. We usually think of things as existing, like I exist, here I am, and all of this other stuff exists too. All of these things that I interact with. Well, this is our usual way of understanding. So he's approaching it from that standpoint, talking about the ultimate nature of being. But he points out that the ultimate nature of being, though, the ultimate nature of being, in effect, is inseparable from non-being. It isn't really being at all. It has these remarkable features that he talks about here. And so when he begins to elaborate these remarkable features, then we should maybe loosen our grip on our ordinary understanding of being and existence. And in particular, especially when he gets down to this last point that he makes, when you grab hold of this frame called you, it always exists. Whatever you take hold of there, it exists alone. You take hold of yourself in the same way, you exist alone too. And this leads to a very difficult existence for us. But of course, this is how we ordinarily understand our situation here. And we act out of that. We understand everything in these terms. We put everything in these terms. And we suffer as a result. And we never really quite understand just what is taking place here. So these are the points that Katagiri Roshi is coming to here. It has several remarkable features, he said. The first is that it is vast, all-pervading, and seamless. Well, these three, vast, all-pervading, and seamless, are just basically three ways of talking about the same thing. And again, as soon as we speak in this way, we put everything in our ordinary terms. I'm here, I'm looking at something else out there, and we use a word like vast, and we think, oh yes, of course the world is vast. The ultimate nature of existence is something vast. So we tend to think of it in terms of, once we grab hold of this frame called me, this individual self, and then we think of something else out there, and then it seems like it's great, it's huge, there's these vast distances, there's this vast array of stuff out there. This is our tendency to see it in this way, but he's speaking about this as a remarkable quality of existence, that it isn't our usual take on it. That another way of looking at this term vast is that it just simply means that you can't get away from it. No matter how far you go, you think you can go out there to some other place. Of course, we never can, we never have, but we think we can. We can go somewhere else. But of course, wherever you are, it's always right here. And so we don't really get away from this. And this is an understanding of this term vast, is that you can't leave it. You can't get outside of it. No matter where you go, no matter how far you go, we are still in the ultimate nature of existence. So this is the understanding of vast as he means it here. As I said, this term vast is also the same term. Well, he has three ways of speaking of this same understanding that he's trying to convey here, that it is vast, all-pervading, and seamless, of course. So the fact that you can see now how when we understand vast in this way, it's all-pervading. That means no matter where you go, whether we go into the vast reaches of space or into the vast world of so many different things and ideas and culture and people. If we go into the small, delicate construction of the world, go into the cells of our bodies, into the molecules that make these things up, into the vast intricacies of existence, into the very atoms, we still find vast reaches that we cannot escape. No matter where we go, on whatever scale, we cannot escape reality. And for this reason, too, then, that is all-pervading. All-pervading is it reaches everywhere. There's no place that we can step into, even what we might imagine, what we conjure up in our minds, the imaginary realities that we come. This is still a part of reality. We cannot step outside of reality at all. We try to imagine stepping outside as if there were some boundary there that we could step across and into some unreality of some sort. But of course, that very imagining itself is a part of this reality. It is all pervading. What he's really getting down to is that the true nature of your existence here, it is vast in this way, it is all-pervading in this way. You cannot step apart from it, and for this reason you also can't step back and look at it objectively, as though you could see yourself as some isolated thing. This relates to all these other points that he brings up about these remarkable qualities of the nature of being. But then this third point then is that it is also seamless. It is seamless in this way. And this will relate to the sixth point that he makes. Because whatever it is that we do find it, we think it is full of seams. There's this and then there's that and there's the next thing. I'm here and there's other, you know, so there's like seams between things, demarcating one thing from another. As if we had a whole collection of different things here. And this is the nature of reality. When he's saying that it is actually seamless, though, it certainly looks that way. It certainly looks as though we have this and that and a multitude of things here. But the fact is that it is seamless. As he says on the sixth point, he gives the example here that you pick up one frame, everything else comes along with it. If we don't notice this, seventh point, you pick up yourself in this way, you're lonely. You have a problem. You need to satisfy yourself in some way. You need to get something. You need to find some warmth and friendliness, some protection. But if we don't see it in that way, you won't be concerned with these issues. They won't come up as sore points in your life because you won't be seeing and understanding your life in that way. It only comes about from seeing ourselves in isolation. So it is seamless in this way, that your life is seamlessly, I don't even want to say connected, because that implies a seam once again. But there's no separation between the most intimate aspects of your life and the nature of reality as a whole. So this is the first aspect or feature of the nature of being, that is vast, all-pervading, and seamless. And then he said that the second is that it lacks form, color. I said sound earlier, that's fine. He didn't mention it here, but could throw it in there. Smell, flavor. It lacks all of these qualities that as sentient beings we pick up. You know, a sentient being is one who's just like the one who sees the self as separate. And now then is living by the senses, by an understanding that we're taking in a world out there. We've forgotten all about the seamlessness aspect of our experience, and we're taking things in from out there. But the ultimate nature of reality is that not only is it seamless, but for that reason it also doesn't have any color, form, sound, smell, flavor. It doesn't have any distinguishing sensory mark like that, that distinguishes it from one thing or another. Of course, everything that we find within this vast collection of stuff like what we find here, of course, it all has sound, color, smell, shape, flavor, and also a lot of emotional and mental qualities too, marking one thing from another. We get caught up with it in our ordinary understanding. It's not that we should ignore any of these features and throw that away, but it's just that ultimate reality doesn't have these features to it. And this is the part that we forget. And so when we go looking for and trying to understand the ultimate nature of reality, we keep looking for something that's going to show up in some kind of a form or flavor or sound or smell or thought or feeling, ignoring the fact that ultimately what we have here doesn't have any kind of a sign like that about it at all. None whatsoever. And we miss this point. And of course, it is the stuff that we do grasp and take hold of that has sound, flavor, smell, whatever. This is what pulls our life all over in all different directions. It leads to the confusion, the pain, the suffering. All of that, we try to reach for something that's going to make us feel better or make us feel protected. We try to steer away from those kinds of things that maybe we find threatening or make us feel bad or whatever. We're ignoring the seamlessness of this all, and that the overall reality itself doesn't have any of these qualities that otherwise send us in so many different directions and leave us caught up in a lot of confusion. So that's the second quality of the ultimate nature, is that it lacks form, color, sound, smell, flavor. The third feature of the ultimate nature of being is that it acts at super speed. He says super speed. So it isn't just that it's fast. Reality is, yeah, of course, it's very, acts at a super speed. I mean, it's instantaneous. Of course, we know, some of you might know about in quantum physics, we talk about quantum leaping, quantum leaping. We think we hear that, such and such was, we took a quantum leap, and it's like we've taken a big step. We use it, and that's how, in our common thinking, that's what we think that term means. What it really means is instantaneous. It means getting from here to there without passing through intervening time or space. It's just one instant here, next instant somewhere else, with no time. So it means something like that. This is what he means by super speed, acting that quickly, that the farthest reaches of our understanding of space and time or of thought, but all of these things are right here. They're immediate because it acts, reality is acting at a super speed. That means that we don't have a past. We don't have a future as such in the way that we commonly think. We think that these things are real and that they exist somewhere else. But nothing exists anywhere else. It is all existing right here. So the actual past that we know is right here, in this moment, right here, right now. But we don't see it that way. We see it as somewhere else. But that past doesn't exist. It is something that we imagine. It's something we make up. And of course, as an imagined thing, it exists, but it is an imaginary thing. But the real past, and the real future, and the real farthest reaches of time and space. It is all right here in this moment, because reality is acting at a super speed. And this also ties back to these original statements, is that it is vast, all-pervading, and seamless. It is all right here, right now. This is the nature of reality. So to the extent that we lose sight of this, we get caught up with this and that, reaching for this, reaching for that, running from that. We have lost sight of the fact that ultimately, the stuff that we would reach for or try to get something from doesn't act in this way. It is acting in some kind of a slow way where we feel like we have to move over here to get that. We have to move over here to get away from that. When ultimately, whatever moving we do in terms of ultimate reality, you haven't gone anywhere. And there's nothing over there for you to get. If you will look very carefully at what is actually taking place right here, you will notice that it is happening right now. It is all right here. We don't need to spend so much time getting caught up in our imaginary, constructed reality of our mind. We can immerse ourselves in what is actually taking place. By the way, too, sometimes when I talk like this, and then people think that I'm speaking in very abstract terms, but I hope if you listen very carefully, you realize what I'm talking about is that our ordinary thinking is the abstraction. And what this teaching is about is to really bring us in to the intimate reality of this moment and what is actually taking place. So if you listen carefully, you can see how if it sounds like we're talking in an abstract terms, turn that around. It's your thinking. It's this grasping mind thinking that we have this as opposed to that, one thing apart from another, and here I am and everything else is separate from me. This is the abstraction. This is not what we know. This is not what we experience. This is not the nature of reality, the ultimate nature of being. It is not like that. And so what this kind of teaching and what Katagiri Roshi is pointing to here is to bring us in the way that I'm characterizing it here. If you listen carefully, it is to bring your attention to what you actually experience in this moment, as opposed to what you think you experience from moment to moment. But this is this nature of this super speed that he's talking about. He said, yet it is always tranquil and quiet, even though it acts at a super speed. Well, it's because it is acting at this super speed reality. You will never be so quick as to somehow miss it. It's always right there, acting at a super speed, always immersed in it, can never leave it. Temporally, spatially, we can never leave it. We're always in it, acting at a super speed. But it's because of that quality that this fourth remarkable feature also appears, in that it is always calm and tranquil, very quiet, he says. This is the fourth feature. He says, in being quiet and tranquil, it reveals the active aspects of human life. So because it is, because the nature of reality just quietly, here, always here, from moment to moment, we're always in it, acting at a super speed, therefore is occurring seamlessly from moment to moment. It is so quiet, so still that we don't notice this. What does it reveal then? It reveals the active nature of our existence here, is what he's saying. So it reveals the active aspect of human life. He said that this is why if you sit down in Zazen, you've all noticed this, I think. Anybody who sits down in Zazen, you'll notice this. This is why if you sit down in Zazen, you can begin to see the highly active aspects of your body and mind. You notice that? You know, when you sit down, you make yourself still, and also you realize your mind is very agitated, moving, jumping about. When we're jumping up around with this, reaching for one thing and another, we don't notice that because we're caught up in that activity. So what he's saying here, if we just, because the actual nature of reality is calm still, you settle down in this way and you begin to realize this active mind that we have, this mind that jumps about. He says the working of the third and fourth features is coincident. They occur at the same time. He said because of this, if your life is too active, so if you become too active, he said you're not satisfied. On the other hand, if you're always quiet, you don't like that either. You know? So avoid these two extremes of being too active. But what he's saying is that when we sit still in this stillness, if we enter into this properly, in other words, that we actually come into it not desiring, not wanting to reach for anything else out there, enlightenment or whatever else you want to put on it. Noticing this activity, acting at the super speed, no matter what is taking place here, it is all acting at a super speed. Just noticing that. In other words, this stillness, this tranquility, this quietness is occurring simultaneously with the dynamic reality of life, this ultimate nature of existence that he's speaking of here. So these things are always going together coincidentally at the same time, is what he's saying. And our practice of meditation is to engage that fully, completely. This is what the meditation is. It is not just to sit quietly. It is to sit quietly within this dynamic nature of reality. This dynamic nature of reality is such that it is always quiet and still and calm. At some point, we can bring our own mind around to realizing this. This is a mind of reality itself, we could say. It is of this nature, both dynamic and yet at the same time very still. I just thought of this line out of T.S. Eliot. I forget where it's from now, but he talks about the stillness. I might have talked on this before somewhere, but he talks about the stillness of the Chinese jar. The movement in the Chinese jar, dynamically acting in the way the Chinese jar. There's a picture, you go to a museum, you see a Chinese jar. It's just sitting there quietly in stillness. And yet he speaks of this dynamic action, this motion. So he's talking about stillness. He's also refers to stillness there. So here, T.S. Eliot did study Buddhism. Any one of us can tune in to what is actually taking place, and you will discover both this stillness and this dynamic action taking place together at once. Just as T.S. Eliot, he found this, and you can find it too. And if you do find this dynamism, that is absolute stillness at the same time, this is called shikantaza. This is the actual sitting, the meditation that we do. But you need to find that. So if you think that it's all about being still, realize that we can't achieve stillness. You know, there's always this dynamism that is taking place. Yet if we continuously go out and move, then we forget all about stillness. So we have to find a way. Kadagiri used to also talk about this same kind of idea here of the wheel turning, rolling, moving along. And it's like the center of the wheel that is very dynamic, and yet at the same time, a perfectly balanced wheel. The center will be very still. It doesn't move. It stays in one point. So he's talking about activity and tranquility. They must work together, activity and tranquility. In everyday life, you have to find tranquility in activity and activity in tranquility. This requires great resolve of will and a clear mind. But don't make any mistake about this. This is what we are learning to do when we sit in meditation. If we get past all the nonsense, the junk that just keeps bubbling up and spinning up, the jabbering that is taking place within our mind, at some point, perhaps, we can find this dynamism that is also stillness. And this dynamism and the stillness are the same. It is only our discriminating mind, our conceptualizing mind, that will pull these two apart and speak of them in the way that I am right now. So that's the third and fourth feature. Then they work together. Okay, so it acts at the super speed, and yet it is always tranquil and calm. Now the fifth feature is that because its nature is very active, the ultimate nature of existence, reality, and this isn't something abstract or apart. This is you. This is you. This is your actual life. It is like this. It really is that this dynamism and the stillness are already here. The seamlessness is all. Everything we're describing here is already. This is how it is. What we need to do is to find this, to realize this, to wake up to this ourselves, and to understand it and to see it for ourselves. Not because Kadagiri Roshi is laying it out like this for us, but because this is how it is. This is what our actual experience is. It is of this nature, and we need to find this for ourselves. But he says the fifth feature is that because its nature is very active, things are constantly arising and perishing. All things are interconnected and arise together, yet each thing arises under different conditions. So that's why when anything does appear here within our experience with flavor and color and form and whatever, it doesn't remain still. Even if it's still like the Chinese jar, it still exhibits dynamism, motion in one aspect or another. And if nothing else, there's this constant arising and perishing of everything that is taking place, no matter how you want to slice it up, whatever you have there that now can be labeled and it's found to be distinct, whether it's you or a plank on the floor or a thought or a feeling, no matter what it is, it exhibits arising and perishing. It comes into existence and it goes out of existence. But this is a continuous thing that the ultimate nature of reality shows us. But things are constantly active in this way, arising and perishing. But then he says that they arise and perish together. This brings us to the sixth feature. The sixth feature is when we are conscious of something, say a tree. It could be anything else you want to put there. It doesn't have to even be a physical thing. It could be a thought, a feeling. He said, precisely and clearly as it appears. So something appears here. Say a tree, precisely and clearly as it appears. All beings appear along with it. All beings appear along with it, but he says, as the very quality of its life. All beings appear along with it. No matter what then takes place here, and of course this includes you, but we don't notice this because we pick up on a thing. And of course, most especially what we pick up on is me, the self. The self is, whenever there is some object out there, whether a thing or a thought or a feeling, or no matter what it is, exhibiting these different characteristics of flavor and sound and color, as soon as something appears, immediately our mind reaches for that thing. We see that thing as a distinct thing. We don't see that thing as an expression of the whole of experience occurring together at once. We don't see it in this way. If we were enlightened, we would. But in our ordinary way, we don't see it in that way. When we talk of it this way, then we think we're talking in abstract terms. When we talk about the thing distinct and separate from others, then we think we're talking in very concrete terms. But if we were awake, we'd realize that this is reversed. That's the abstraction, that we find something separate and distinct and apart from others. So this is kind of what he's saying here then, is that the sixth feature is that when we are conscious of something, say a tree, precisely and clearly as it appears, all beings appear along with it. But he says, as the very quality of its existence, as the very quality of its life. So that we don't have anything here at all unless it's appearing within a context. Anytime you take something out of its context, you take the tiger out of the forest, throw him in a cage. Is it a tiger? You know, what do we have? What is it? Of course, we have something here, but is it a tiger? Or we kill the tiger and dissect the tiger, and are we going to find the tiger? What is the tiger? What we would call tiger, a real tiger, is a tiger in the world, dynamically interacting with everything that is taking place. The tiger is inseparable. Because the moment you move outside of what we commonly think of as a tiger, distinct and separate in our consciousness, apart from other things that are not tiger, the moment you move to include, well, we realize we got to have the forest here to have a tiger as a tiger really is. If we want to understand the biology of the tiger, we can't understand this without the ecology and everything that also is a part of this tiger. So, but the moment we step outside of what we commonly thought was just, well, that was the tiger over here. Well, where does this now stop? And we cannot stop this reaching out further and further. In other words, the very identity, the quality of what this thing is, drags everything else into it as a part of its identity, as a part of what it truly is. And this part is omitted as we commonly think of one object, separate and distinct from something else. Now, Katagiri Roshi says that when you think of yourself in this way, this is the seventh point here. He says, even though all things exist in this moment, all beings together in this moment, this is what we have here at any. This is the nature of reality. It is always just like this. He said, the moment the single frame of your consciousness picks up this distinct object, he said, then you see it as absolutely alone. And he says, when you pick up yourself in this way, you will find yourself alone too. You will appear alone too. And of course, here's the crux of the problem. This is how we do commonly see ourselves. We see ourselves as alone, separate, distinct. This drives us to virtually all of the kind of activity, the pain, the suffering, the confusion that makes up our life as we commonly live it. But this is only due to our thinking, only due to the way that we're seeing ourselves. Because in spite of that, we always are interconnected in the way in the ways that Katagiri Roshi has been speaking of here all along. This is how we truly exist in this world, not separate and apart from anything else. But if you see it that way, getting caught, this, by the way, just to remind you, this section that he's speaking of here comes in this section on egolessness. When we see it that way, not in an egoless way, but in we see everything according to our own peculiar point of view, our egoistic way of looking at things. This is how we see it. This is the very suffering. And once again, another way in which we turn it all around and have it backwards, all of the effort that we make to please ourselves, to protect ourselves, it is all for nothing. Because this is all caught up in the very ways that cause us to suffer. That not just cause us to, but that is our suffering. So if we were to not see it in that way, how do we not see it in these usual ways that we do? Well, it is to look at this very carefully in the way that Katagiri, he points these things out to us. It's not that we should believe this or think it is so because Katagiri Roshi said so, or because he said this is how Buddhism teaches, and it does. No, that's not good enough. We have to realize this for ourselves. In other words, we need to learn to settle down here to see just what is taking place. One of the best ways is in noticing yourself in your own mind. This reaching that is taking place within your own mind to find something out there apart from you. Realize if you were awake, you wouldn't see anything apart from you in the first place. So when you see yourself reaching in this way, you ask yourself, well, what do you think you're going to get from this? How many things have you actually gotten that have done the trick? If you look carefully, none of them. Momentarily, you get this thing. You know, momentarily. Did the trick, made you happy for a moment. Because now, if it's something that we think is really important, then we worry that maybe we're going to lose it. It will pass away. It will die away. Because we know that everything that does form that way, it has that characteristic of coming and going. But the ultimate nature of reality just shows us this. The ultimate nature of reality itself isn't one that comes and goes. It is always like this. It is always just us. We ignore that because we're always finding ourselves separate and apart from something else. And now there's that reaching that is taking place within our mind. That's why I say, like with the leaning, if you look, observe your mind leaning toward and away. Very helpful for us to start to notice that whatever it is that you're leaning toward or away from, look at that very carefully. What do you ever accomplish by this? And we try to steer this in such a way to make ourselves happy, to make ourselves feel protected. But we never do feel entirely protected. We never feel entirely happy. Momentarily, we experience happiness. You know. But we never really achieve anything. There's a quiet, continuous, all-pervading, I don't even want to call it happiness, but peace of mind, tranquility, which is also dynamic, that is right here for us to find, to wake up to. This is what Katagiri Roshi is pointing to. How is it that we miss it? Because we keep reaching for that thing or that thing. We talk about this enlightenment, awakening to, as he says elsewhere in this book, it doesn't occur on the mountain of ego. It's on the mountain of egolessness that we find this enlightenment. But we look for this thing that is this freedom from this kind of disturbance of mind. And we make it once again into another thing that we would go after, enlightenment, awakening. We turn our practice of meditation into, I'm sitting down so that I can get something. This teaching over and over and over again tells us this isn't the way it's done. But we do this so habitually, so commonly. But at some point, we have to take this to heart, to see this, to realize what we're doing in each moment. And at some point, maybe we can taste the actual freedom that is already ours. That is ours just for the awakening to it. Best way to do this is to notice, catch yourself in the act of reaching, especially in this moment when you are trying to get something out of this practice and out of this kind of teaching. What there is to be gotten out of this is not something that can be gotten. But you don't need to get it. We only need to wake up and realize that you have it, so to speak. Not really correct, but we can put it that way. that it is already yours. This is the ultimate true nature of existence. That is yours already. This is what you are. We can only wake up to this. We can't get it. It isn't something we can get. It doesn't belong to, it doesn't have that nature. Best way is just to see what you're doing. Catch yourself in the act of reaching for something. When your concern is to wake up. If your concern is to feed yourself, sure, reach for the saucepan, the frying, you know, the potatoes, or whatever. But when it comes to this matter of waking up to what is going on here, to not be insane and to be confused, you don't need to reach for it. You have to catch yourself in the act of reaching for that. You know, years ago, when I got into this practice as a young man, it was a very ordinary way. I wanted enlightenment. I didn't want to suffer. But at some point, I realized I'd been told over and over and over again through my readings, through talking with Katagiri and other people who seemed to understand. You know, and it took me a long time even to understand what do you mean? But at some point, you have to catch yourself in the act and realize, this is what the awakened tell us. You know, don't do that. You don't need to do that. The quality of your mind shifts, it changes. The way you practice shifts and changes. Practice becomes something very easy, so to speak, or at least, easy might not be the right word, but it's not difficult. It isn't something, I gotta get something from this. It means step into it now, right now. Just step into it and carry on. And any one of us, you can just do that, but you have to take this to heart. This isn't playing some kind of games here. Just take this to heart and to do it. But anyway, we can find these seven remarkable qualities of being here. Well, anyway, that was more than I could have said in a class, so you got it today, thanks to Norm. So, but anyway, do you have any questions about that? Or does this just leave you speechless, huh?
When you talk about acts of super speed,
yeah,
you know, is there any correlation between, you know, when you talk about the quantum leap, it just happens outside of, or, you know, it's timeless.
It's timeless, yeah.
Immediate.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like Dogen's spring becomes spring, doesn't it?
Well, spring doesn't become summer. He says, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a related understanding. Yeah, because spring is spring. Spring is immediately spring. Spring doesn't become summer. See, when we think spring is a distinct thing and a separate thing, and then we have something else that's summer, and so we see spring gradually becoming summer. But actually, how can spring be summer? It's the same kind of idea of the self. I was a child. Well, what does that even mean? Because we speak in this way, but the I that we have here is not a child. See? So how does a child become an adult? Well, a child doesn't become an adult. A child is a child. But does an adult manifest? Sure. Under the proper conditions, at the proper time, adult shows up. You see, but it isn't a child becoming an adult because a child is a child. There's a interesting paradox that, I forget the fellow who came up with this, but the paradox of Amphibious, you probably know it because I wrote about it once. Yeah, Amphibious takes a movie of a tadpole. It's a hypothetical thing. And you put it in a tank of water, tadpole, and you start shooting a movie of this. 24 frames a second. Okay, continuously shooting this tadpole for 3 weeks. Well, after 3 weeks, something like, 50 million frames, I forget how many, millions of frames were shot. And in the first frames, you see a tadpole. It keeps, you know, frame after frame. It looks pretty much like a tadpole. Well, then we go to the end, we got a frog. See? And then according to logic, he said that somewhere, mathematically, you try to figure this out. He said that there's somewhere in this event, we got to have a frame of a frog that's immediately preceded by a frame of a tadpole. Well, you find it. Yeah, you know, and Why do we even think this? Well, it's because we think that we have something there, and we name that thing. Call amphibious. Here's amphibious in frame one and frame two, you know, all the way up to frame 50 million or whatever it is. But if this is amphibious, you pull frame one here. This is amphibious? What's amphibious? See? What is it? See, we think that we can have something that changes. Yeah, well, you can't have something that changes. And because if you had something that changes, it's not a thing. Is there change? Yes, there is change. Is there dynamism? Yes, there is. You know, but it isn't of something becoming something else. That's impossible. See? When we're awake, we see that. You can see that this is how it is. You know, and when you do, you're spared a great deal of confusion. When you don't understand that point, the whole world is a lot of mystery here. It's also a lot of pain and suffering. That's because we think we have something that can change. We think we have things that's called me, that I can change and still be me. What becomes something other than itself and still remains itself? We don't find anything like that. This is part of our thinking. This is our intellection. Our intellectual self understands in this way. But were we to see reality as it's actually unfolding in this moment, nothing ever appears this way. Well, I shouldn't say that. No, that is how it appears. But nothing actually is this way. We don't find anything like this. It doesn't make sense. It's a contradiction. This is why we're all confused about reality. It's very confusing. I mean, that's why you can just ask yourself the question, well, do I know what's going on? No, I don't. When we think like that. But this doesn't mean that you can't see what's going on. We can. But we won't think like that. Well, you might think like that, but you know better. In other words, to the awakened, this whole conundrum of amphibious is not a conundrum. It's not a paradox. There's nothing confusing about it whatsoever. Because we think it's the same thing. Somehow it's got to be the same thing. And then we start to look at it very carefully like this. We think, well, wait a minute now. Well, when does a tadpole become the frog? Mathematically, like you said, there has to be one frame here where suddenly it's a frog following a tadpole. Well, of course, that's absurd. And we feel it's kind of absurd. Well, it's because in our inner reaches of our understanding, we know that we are in touch with reality, so we know it's absurd. But when you bring it intellectually, you bring it out like this, and we're trying to understand, we grasp it, we try to get some idea of what's going on here, it doesn't make any sense. And yet, because we're always reaching for our conceptual understanding of what's going on here, and reality won't go into a conceptual form, it leaves us feeling confused, like, you know, I life's a mystery. I don't understand it. Well, actually, it's not a mystery. It's only a mystery because you keep trying to grasp it. See, that's again the points that he's making here. You don't have to grasp it. But it feels very uncomfortable at first, because we feel like we have to grasp it. I don't get it. You know, we're always doing this. That's once again what I was talking about before. Watch yourself reaching. Notice what you're doing there. Do you think you're going to get it? Whether you get the car, the house, the job, or the idea, is this really going to do the trick? No, it won't. It will never do the trick. Momentarily, it might feel better. But in the next moment, didn't do the trick. And we reach for, well, I've got to reach for some more stuff here. At some point, we have to realize what we're doing. And when you do, you realize, there isn't anything mysterious about it. Now we're talking about, once again, going, and do you need a car, a house, job? Yeah, I'm sure, maybe, probably. So take care of those things. They're not such big issues. But when it comes to this deep problem of what's this all about, where am I going, where did I come from, what is life, what happens to me after I die, we're still grasping. And you'll never find anything there to satisfy. But you don't need to. You don't need to do that. All we need to do is just see what's happening now. And we never find anything becoming something else and still being remaining what it is. So that tadpole here is not that tadpole or this or that frog. There it is. Look, there we have that. We have this. We have this. That's what we have now. See, how many Bruces have heard this lecture? Well, you know, we can't count. This is why, too, like in the meal chants, we talk about Shakyamuni Buddha, the, you know, the historical Buddha, the man, the person. We talk about Buddhas, Shakyamuni Buddhas. Why? It's because there's who knows how many. Infinite. Same thing with you. It's not really infinite, but it might just as well be. Because of the super speed that everything is acting. But we don't see it that way. We see it as, you know, as if I'm the same me I was 2 weeks ago, or 10 years ago, or 50 years ago. You know, no, it's ridiculous. You say, well, of course, 50 years ago, yeah, you were really different, but you're still the same. Well, okay, what's the same? Well, that's our grasping mind. We're holding on to something here that doesn't change. If we look carefully at our experience, we realize we don't find anything like that. Were we to see that, you'd awaken, you'd be spared a great deal of suffering, a great deal of confusion. Well, maybe we've gone over here. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much.